Okay, we're going to not come to order because we haven't got enough people, but we're going to start anyway. Representative Hosh, you can come to the table. Mr. Griffin, will please take his seat and quit causing a stir. If our guests will please find a comfortable chair for themselves. If people can grab a chair, please, it'd be great. If Upton Tall would quit making so much noise, it would sure help. He'd wake up from his nap. Upton was testy as he was quick, sir. If you can all take your seats, we'll start, and if you can be quiet, that would help us a lot. So Upton Hosh can come to the table. Where'd he go? Oh. He's busy working on his bill. We have a fair amount of work to do. I want to welcome our special guests who are in the audience again, some people with special needs and some of their caregivers and people with concerns. All of us share those concerns, so we are riding this roller coaster together. Representative Hosh, we haven't got a quorum yet, but we're going to take up your bill and you can start talking about it.
Which one?
580. Oh, there's two. Oh, yeah, there's a... Yeah, another one's for later on, I guess, today. So. Controversy seems to follow you wherever you go, Representative Hosh. So.
Mr. Chair, I can attest that I am not following the controversy. It is definitely following me. Mr. Chair, there's no quorum here, but on House File 580, I do want to let the committee know that once there is a quorum, I intend to delete sections 3-7, and that would be lines 3.11 to 9.13. And the purpose for these deletions is because these areas would have a fiscal impact to the state, and we would like to deal with the policy side of this and not have to deal with the fiscal matters that we can't meet because of our situation. Mr. Chair, sections 1 and 2, I can address, but I know that you're probably much more familiar with, and also there's individuals here that I think will eventually want to testify that deal with how assets are defined when it comes to MFIP programs and making sure that those assets can't be shielded by a separate entity or business that may have been set up. Section 8 is a technical change that simply says that an eligible person for services must comply with the provisions within the bill. Section 9 is probably the most significant portion. What this says is that if a county believes that an MFIP participant who is possibly up for sanctions but eligible for family stabilization services, or they believe is eligible for family stabilization services, that they can't be sanctioned. And we want to make sure that people with disabilities or a mental illness or whatnot that is having a hard time meeting the requirements under MFIP aren't being sanctioned when they are thought to be eligible for more appropriate programs. That is pretty much the crux of the bill, Mr. Chair. With me is Jessica Webster from, it seems like today's favorite organization, Minnesota Legal Services Law, and she can be here to answer any questions. And I apologize. Section 10 is a technical change also.
So, do you want to testify?
Or just, Mr. Chair, it's not necessary to have any questions.
Do members have questions to the bill as it's going to be amended? I know there's someone from Sonoka County wants to testify about this. Do the quorum. Okay. We have a quorum. Oh, officially come to order. Oh, where'd you come from? That's been hot. Anyway, nice you can be here. And so you move House File 580 to be held over? Oh, I should read the sheet. Oh, going back to finance. Okay. And let's take on your, so you want to move your amendment then?
Sure, Mr. Chair. I would move to delete sections 3-7, lines 3.11 through 9.13.
So Representative Hosh moves to delete sections 3-7, making it a much smaller bill, saving a lot of money on paper. Any questions about the deletion? It was already explained, but hearing no questions, all those in favor of the oral amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The bill's in order, we should talk about it. So any people understand that? I think Duncan County wants to come down and talk about something. I'd welcome. Why don't you come down? And I am one of the finest counties Minnesota has. Well run, good place to raise your kids. They did produce me, so I can't give them a whole ringing endorsement. But that's in a hush.
Mr. Chair, I was born and grew up in Anoka County, too. So.
I knew I liked you.
It is a good county. Great.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and tell us what's on your mind. You have a couple minutes. So.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. Thanks for allowing me to speak. I am Thomas Rachel, and I have had the privilege of being an employee and also a resident of Anoka County. I've been employed by the county attorney's office for the past 35 years as an investigator. I'm not a welfare fraud investigator. However, I do investigate welfare fraud as it is assigned to me with other white-collar crimes such as contractor fraud, theft fraud, mortgage fraud, etc. In recent years, there has been an increase in requests for investigations into eligibility for health care programs, specifically the Medical Assistance of Minnesota Care Program. Most of these requests are generated by investigators and personnel active in the state of Minnesota fraud prevention program or housed with a county financial assistance specialist. Generally, these requests for investigations are focused on applicants and recipients who are self-employed. At the application interview, self-employed individuals are requested to produce bank statements, U.S. individual tax return form 1040, which are used to verify the applicant's adjusted gross monthly or annual income. There's an asset limitation for eligibility for adults, and the limitation for two adults is $20,000. The residence of an occupied, if occupied by the family, is not considered an asset. Financial specialists, when examining these applicants for eligibility, do not focus on the homestead because it is exempt if children only are applied for or if adults are applied for. Question 20 on the standard health care program application inquires about real property as to value. However, the application does not inquire if there's a mortgage on the property, the amount of the monthly mortgage, or if it's current on its payment. An inquiry into the monthly mortgage payment and if the payment is current would disclose a more accurate response to their monthly income. When I receive a request for investigation, I look at the value of the real property, the mortgage or mortgages on the property, and the date of the mortgages. If the property is in foreclosure and if the monthly mortgage payment is current. We look at homes valued at anywhere from $340,000 to $750,000 that are on these applications. House file number 580 addresses this issue. These investigations frequently result in the investigation of finances, which includes an examination of bank accounts and income tax returns. It has been my experience and the experience of other investigators in my office that these self-employed individuals are paying personal expenses from business accounts, such as mortgage payments, utilities, groceries, liquor, salons, etc. The Department of Human Services policy is that money in a business account used to pay personal expenses, such as mortgages, utilities, groceries, liquor, salons, etc., cannot be considered as personal income for eligibility purposes. DHS has been notified of this issue and has not rectified it. Minnesota Statute 256.98, theft by wrongfully obtaining assistance, dictates the criteria required to refer these completed investigations to Anoka County prosecutors. As is required by Minnesota Statute 256.98, there are two criteria that must be established. First, we must have a false representation or an omission. And secondly, the amount of assistance incorrectly paid must be the difference between the amount actually received on the basis of a false representation and the amount that would have been paid had the concealment not occurred. The prosecutors in our office informed our investigators that if DHS policy is that money used to pay personal expenses from a business account cannot be considered as income for eligibility purposes, then they cannot in good conscience prosecute the individuals who pay personal expenses from their business accounts. I found that the Form 1040 U.S. individual tax return that is presented to financial specialists by self-employed individuals applying for health care programs that have been referred for investigation generally do not reflect the individual's true gross taxable income. The Minnesota Department of Revenue is prohibited from acknowledging to anyone if the Form 1040 presented for income, proof of income for health care eligibility is the same Form 1040 filed with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. The families with large assets have the option of applying for health care programs for their children, as assets are not considered, only their income. I have here a Form 1040 from 2006 that was used to apply for health care benefits for children only. It states that the business income was $35,811. The taxable income, the taxable income was $20,119. Now, when I examine this, I looked at the application, and the application for this individual states that they have a timeshare valued at $10,000, they have $477 in checking, $626 in checking, $4,500 in an IRA, they have $41,018 in an IRA, $80,000 in an IRA, and $54,500 in a mutual fund. These are all assets, and they're not looked at for eligibility for medical for children. They stated that their house was valued at $486,800, and they owed $559,000 on it. In addition to that, they stated they had a cash value insurance policy of $511,000 and $150,000. In addition, they also had a Thrivent policy for $45,000. We examined their records by use of court orders, and we found out that there were actually two mortgages on the property, one for $567,000 with a monthly payment of $4,525, and a second mortgage of $107,000 with a monthly payment of $679. They were current on their payments. Now, further examination upon their income.
Mr. Rachel, if I think you're going to lose this one.
Lose it? Okay, at any rate, their income exceeded what they disclosed.
You're speaking in favor of Section 2, right?
Yeah.
Okay, just to help us get our arms around it, because I appreciate that. So,
That's all I have to say. I have other cases. Now, do I have any idea how many cases there are like this throughout the state of Minnesota? No, sir, I don't. I only know the ones that are referred to me, and I know that the language that they use allows this conduct to continue.
I appreciate that, and I know that... we had a meeting up in the county talking about some of that. And what was the ratio of money you thought you could, if you put a dollar in, you say five or something, into some of these findings?
What is the value of some of these?
Well, like if you invest a dollar in some of the, reviewing some of these cases, you get back $5 in program.
I have no idea, Chairman. Oh. I have no idea. I'm an investigator employed by the county attorney's office. I am not involved in that other program.
All right. Yeah, the head in the audience, the commissioner says it's $5. It's just kind of interesting, and this language helps you capture that income as you consider eligibility for these various programs. Is that correct?
Correct.
All right.
All we're asking them to do is actually match what the Minnesota Department of Revenue or the Internal Revenue Service requires.
All right. I think that's insightful. It's too bad this all comes in the last week of session. We're all, our heads are all just jumbled up with everything, but I appreciate it coming forward with that. Any questions for the witness? Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is kind of the end of session, so I'm trying to get my hands around this. If I remember the conversation we had before about this, what I'm trying to figure out is why it's necessary to have this in the bill when we already have asset limits, and what this specifically would do to change and help the testifier, which I don't have his name in front of me, how it would help his job, how this would enhance or better, he would be better able to do his job if we enhanced what our eligibility guidelines are today.
Mr. Rachel.
The problem is that DHS policy is if you pay your personal expenses out of your business accounts, they cannot look at that as personal income for eligibility. And if that's the policy and we discover this, we're not going to be able to pursue this.
Representative Hayden.
So we're kind of going around the bin to try to figure out what a person's what an individual would be making by looking at their assets, as opposed to maybe changing the policy of DHS's policy that says that maybe we should look at their business expenses versus their personal expenses. I mean, I'm trying to figure that out.
Yeah, Representative Hayden, having been self-employed in the past, my expenses are what I say they are, and I'm supposed to back them up with evidence. But if you have a business, you're not supposed to take your food out of that and call that a business expense. You're not supposed to take your mortgage out of that and call that a business expense. And apparently what they've found, if I understand right from our meetings, is that some people are taking their living expenses out of their business and calling that business expense to get their income down low enough to qualify for a program, when in actuality they're well above the line, in this case, way above the line, when they should have qualified.
Mr.
That help?
Yeah, no, that does help. That's against the law. I mean, that's against... They would have a problem with the IRS if they're doing that, right? If the IRS caught them. Is that right?
And
absolutely. The problem we're having is that DHS policy says that they should not look at that as personal income if it's in their business account. We're asking them just to follow IRS rules. We've brought to that their attention, and that hasn't occurred, so we're asking them to clarify it by this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hayden, you are correct. I think for tax purposes, they would be in violation of the law. But in purposes for public programs, that with DHS policy, that is allowable. So we're trying to merge the two to be more consistent with each other, where the IRS and the Department of Revenue policy matches that of the Department of Human Services.
Representative Hayden? Take as long as you want. It's fine.
No, that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just worried about the unintended consequences of this, and so to the testifier, can you tell us approximately how many of these cases you've investigated or that you found that this is happening over the last year, or maybe even the last 2 years?
Cases that have been brought to the attention of investigators in our office over the last 3 years are probably 20 of these cases. I am not aware of any other counties that are even looking at this.
That's from Hayden.
So if there were 20 cases that, thank you, Mr. Chair, there are 20 cases that were brought to you, once again, how does this provision in the bill change the way in which you would go about?
The problem is, maybe an easier way to do this would be if I were to put my money in a business account and pay all my personal expenses out of it, that would not be considered personal income for medical assistance purposes.
So it just takes you a little longer to follow the trail versus what we're doing here today, which will establish this up front. Is that what we're trying to do?
No, it's actually bigger than that, because what the prosecutors in our office are telling us is if the DHS policy is that you cannot look at personal expenses paid out of business accounts as income, if that's what applicants for public assistance are being told and that's what our financial services people are being told, then there's nothing we can do to enforce this.
Representative Huntley.
Yeah, I just want to comment on this. What they're saying is they don't know it's a 1040 that they give to be eligible for this program is the same 1040 that they filed for their income taxes. So they may be all right with the IRS, but they're cheating on the form that they show us, and we have no way right now of determining that. And the example that he used is a individual who was paying his mortgages of like $5,000 a month out of his business and not counting that as part of his personal income. And so this person is, if it was a medical assistance eligibility, he'd be guilty of federal fraud as well as state fraud on it. If you remember Representative Simon's bill, we passed his bill, the amount of money that the state's going to get for every fraud case we uncover is going to be very significant.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that I think part of the confusion here is maybe the way this thing is drafted, because we're talking about business income expenses, but putting it in the asset piece of it. And so it's kind of combining the two things. I think it's probably better drafted to go in the income section of our law to say that business expenses count as income. because here we're basically, you know, we're talking about business assets against the asset test, but then we're kind of applying that as income, which is a different, kind of a different piece of the analysis. So I think that I think the point that is being made is a good one, that we should count, if someone's paying for their food and their groceries out of their business account, that should count as their income.
Right.
I think everybody's agreed on that, but the way this is drafted, it's in the asset test part of it. And so maybe we need to kind of redraft it in some sense.
Maybe we'll
do it in a different way.
And Ms. Spinelli, you want to comment about that? Were you following that conversation about the where it's cited? Would it be better put somewhere else? Not for today, but along the way.
Mr. Chair, members, that may be a good idea. I don't know. This is actually something that I didn't draft, and it is more in Mr. Chung's area than mine.
Oh, okay. Well, I think
I think we're all agreeing on the point of the section. It may be that we have to kind of, and maybe not, but if that's what you're,
yes, absolutely.
But I think it's confusing the way it's drafted, and so maybe if we can just understand that the point of it going forward here, and that we may have to revisit the way it's drafted.
I think that's wise, Rep. Sanchez, and I think that we've kind of discussed the theme of it. I think Rep. Sinahash can sit down, and I can help if you want, and Mr. Chan or whomever. It did come from Anoka County, and it's good they can come forward. And we have to keep moving along to get a few more bills done here, but thank you, Mr. Rachel, for coming and for calling this to our attention. Any questions for the rest of the bill? No questions. Rep. Sinahash renews his motion that House Bill 580 as amended. This is great having a script. You recommended it pass and be returned to the Committee on Finance. Anybody got a problem with that? Okay. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
So noted. Okay. Rep. Norton, are you here? Oh, there she is. Thanks, Rep. Sinahash. Okay, Rep. Norton, I'll move for you that the House Bill 1276 is recommended to pass and be returned to the Committee on Finance. And you have some amendments, I understand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do indeed have a number of amendments, and if we could move through, there's four separate amendments. If we could move each of them, and then I'll speak to the bill at the end. Perhaps we could start with the A3.
Yeah, actually, just so it's convenient to do that, but it's not always appropriate. A3. Oh, the A3 is coming. And actually, since I'll just give you my philosophy on amendments that are at the second committee of hearing compared to the first one. In the first committee, you could have it however you want it because you introduced the bill, however you like. But when you bring it to another committee, it's changed from what the other committee thought was in it. So they just want to give us a little heads up.
Mr.
on
Chair,
each amendment, and that would be
these
fine.
Bills, this bill is a compilation of a whole variety of issues and areas, mostly surrounding counties, and the amendments are as disparate as the bill itself. And so,
well, since they're disparate, why don't you explain the first one, just in brief? And is that okay?
Yes, but I'm not necessarily an expert on each of the areas of each of these amendments, so if you have specific questions of each amendment, I will have to ask someone to come help me explain that. The first one is home health aid. It is in the Senate language, and we are moving this. We're asking that you move this particular amendment so we're in sync with the Senate, and we add this component, which is a totally new component, to the bill.
Is it? You're on the A3 amendment, are you?
It is the A3 amendment. Medication reminder, accreditation.
And just, you know, the Senate isn't always right, so catching up then isn't always a benefit. But anybody have a question on the A3 amendment? I'm just giving you a hard time, Rep. Norton. It's just fun to have you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions on the amendment? Hearing none. All in favor of the A3, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. So, all opposed? See? No opposition. The amendment's adopted. See, you're on a roll here.
Thank
Which you. One do you want next?
The A6, please. I'm taking an easy one first.
I'll move the A6 amendment. So this is also making it like the Senate because they're smarter than us, pretty much. What does that do?
This is a DHS department amendment. They're trying to avoid conflicts with federal law. This too would match the Senate language.
And so for your favor of avoiding conflicts with DHS, then this
Absolutely.
Is what that one's about then. Anybody have any questions about the A6 amendment?
I don't know.
Representative Gottwalt has a question. You know, he likes the amendment. He likes to avoid conflicts. All in favor of A6, please say aye. Oh, wait, it's in your packet. Do you have there's a packet under 1276. We don't need to rush through these. It's important people know what they're voting on.
Thanks.
Did you find it? And anybody have any questions? Okay, all in favor of A6 to make the department happy, please say aye. Aye. All opposed. Two people don't want the department to be happy, but most of us did, so that's adopted. which one do you want next up?
A7, please. And A7. I do have a typo oral amendment and a brief addition. On line 1.9, there's a misspelling of interment. It should not have the N in it, so if you would strike the M.
Okay.
And on line 2.30, the very last line of the bill, after the period, if you could insert and burial or interment.
And I will move those amendments and incorporate them into my motion. On line 1.9, we're striking the N in internment, make it interment. And on 2.30, after remains, we're adding and burial or interment. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And I'll incorporate those. Anybody, do you want to explain what the salient changes are about this? I know you've been working a lot on this.
I have indeed. Mr. Chair, in the last committee health care policy that this bill was heard, there were some concerns raised by actually members at the table, as well as a couple of religious organizations about some of the language. So this has been worked through, and I think maybe a member will speak to this, with the Catholic and Jewish organizations, as well as the counties. And I think we have now reached language that everybody is comfortable with. But we'll see after we move the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Anybody have any questions? Is this doesn't affect the cap that's in the bill in a different place, does it? Is that still alive and well elsewhere? The funeral cap, the price cap, is that elsewhere?
Mm-hmm.
I like that particular piece. Representative Gottwald has questions about interment.
I feel like I maybe need to be interred by the time we're done with this session. But Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, as I read this, we are now adding a mandate to what counties shall do. I'm not arguing whether it's a good thing for them to do or not, but this does look like an unfunded mandate.
Oh, Mr. Chair, this is brought to us by the county at their request to allow them another option. Currently, they have to provide funeral services for all indigent MA patients that are in their care. This will allow them another option, and quite honestly, it could be a lesser cost. Options, and we've tried very carefully to put language in here so it will not offend anyone's personal choices, and as you read, perhaps their moral and faith values as well. So this is at the request of the county, and I don't think they see it as a mandate. I think they see it as another option to help them.
And that's the Norton. Sometimes you don't know what the people's faith was, so you have to make a good estimate, and that's what this is about. Any questions about that?
Yeah.
Mr.
Chair.
Representative Liebling. Oh, who's the first? Representative Fritz?
Mr. Chairman and members, I actually did bring this to the attention of the author, and I appreciate her using the word burial throughout. As a strong woman of faith, and many of our constituents as well are strong folks of their faith, I thought that we had to have that in the bill. And the county, of course, has again agreed to this and to this language. We've had a number of discussions over the past few days. We do have the Jewish, the Lutheran, and the Catholic folks with us, and we've all come to an agreement on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do appreciate that there's been a lot of work on this by a lot of folks, as I initially had the concern that, you know, this is something that basically the state or the county is paying for, and that I don't know if it's constitutional to have the state do something in addition because of somebody's faith. And I appreciate that this now kind of makes it the same for everybody, sort of, even though it still has language about faith in it. It really takes that out because it says that everybody kind of has the same opportunity regardless of whether it's faith-based or whatever the reason for their preference might be, which is a good thing. I have to say I kind of would like to hear from the counties, because I still do really sort of have the concern that that, you know, if people want something done beyond the minimum, that really I think they should be paying for it. Or if their family comes forward and says, you know, gee, I don't like the minimum for whatever reason, that then the counties have to pay for that, for something beyond the minimum. And so I do have a bit of a concern. You know, if I'm indigent and the county is going to pay for my burial, you know, can my spouse come forward and say, well, she has this religious practice, or we don't like that, it's not good enough. So, anyway, I see Mr. Carlson's at the table. Maybe he can give me some comfort on this.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling,
Introduce yourself for the tape.
I'm sorry.
Even though we know who you are, the tape doesn't know who you are.
Minnesota Intercounty Association. The language that is before you has been amended, was characterized correctly by Representative Norton, that it provides us the option of cremating the remains of indigent individuals if there is not a objection, either as indicated by the deceased before he or she passed, or by the spouse or next of kin. We're just trying to be respectful of those, which frankly is current practice, and I don't think I can really make any more comments.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. You know, I guess it's the shall pay part of this that gives me pause, and I appreciate that you're not complaining about it, but you know, I think on behalf of the taxpayers, I sort of am, because, you know, the county, I'm on line 1.13, the county agency shall pay an amount for funeral expenses, including transportation of the body. And so, at one time, I know there was some talk about this being optional for counties, and I guess as I'm sitting here trying to read this quickly, is this optional or is it mandatory on the county?
Let me just be clear. The shall pay has always been in law. We have always shall paid for funeral services and burial for our indigent MA County clients. What this is doing is simply saying, or we shall pay for the cremation. So we're not changing current practice, and I hear your objection to perhaps we never should have been, but I'm not saying that one way or another, but if that is your objection, I'm not trying to change current law. I'm just trying to add to the current practice.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Norton. I hear you. You've done what you were asked to do on this. I'm not complaining at all to my roomie at all about this. And we've had some discussion about this, but I just want to say that, you know, if our attempt here is to reduce mandates to counties, and we are in this really restrictive funding situation, I rather see the money go to people who are living than to people who are dead for burials. And I appreciate the sensitivity for families and all that, but I really kind of think that it kind of, for me, comes down to what do we owe people, and if the kind of sort of bare bones burial, you know, something that would be respectful, you know, cremation and interment, you know, fine. But I sort of feel like if people want more, if families want more, they could certainly find ways to pay for it. That's my feeling. Maybe that's the counties aren't ready to push it that far. I'm not going to vote no, but I just want to put that on the record. Thank you.
Well, this is attractive from interest. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, I'm looking at line 2.27 of the bill, everything after if neither. Do you know in the state of Minnesota how many people we bury a year that we really don't know anything about their traditions or who they are, or John Doe burials that we do? I'm wondering how many people we're talking about.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bean, I do not know the exact count. I do know the expenditure, and it is approximately $3.5 million annually for the latest year for which information is available. Mm-hmm. I understand in the last year for which information is available, that was $8,000 in Hennepin County alone. I do want to, you know, address some of the concerns that have been mentioned here about providing costly services to these individuals. Basically, all the counties have negotiated basically standard service agreements with the funeral industries in their respective counties that run in the neighborhood of $2,000 to $2,500. So these are by no means expensive, all the frills type funerals that are being provided. But again, the cremation option, which there's no statutory presumption whatsoever for under current law for MCIT recipients, is an option that we would like to have available by statute to us.
Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Carlson, I guess if the most controversial portion of this bill is that we are cremating some folks that may or may not be in disagreement with their faith or their faith tradition, and some of these folks are buried or cremated, who they are we find out about maybe months or years later. We can, when you look at cremation or burial, one is you can exhume somebody that we buried, but you can't uncremate somebody. So I think that would be the most troubling portion of this amendment. So I would move to strike everything after if and after in line 2.27 to 2.30. And I think that the number of folks that we would be catching within that would be relatively small compared to the large amount of the expenditure that Mr. Carlson stated. We don't have the information before us of how few people this is, but I think that this would be more respectful of the faith traditions of the folks in our state. So I would
let me get that amendment clear up from Dean. So after the period on 2.27?
After the period, after the word kin and period, strike everything thereafter.
Well, the whole rest of it. So Justin Dean moves to actually, so you would strike the new language? You're going to delete the whole... You just want to strike the new language that's there? You just want to delete that from the bill? Okay. So that's going to be moved to delete everything after the word kin, period, on line 2.27 and following to the end.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Carlson.
Okay. Well, the section that's being amended here is the section that applies to indigent burials for everybody besides former MCIT recipients. We have the authority under current law, if you read lines 2.27 through 2.30 without the insertions and the stricken language, to provide for the disposition of the remains in any manner that we deem to be appropriate or respectful. If you delete this language, you're taking that away from us and making the process more expensive.
Well, I think actually the amendment, Mr. Carlson, would just take away the new language. It just, we're not repealing the remainder of that section.
Deleting the new language?
Right, not removing the mandatory cremation. That's what the motion would be.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Norton.
I would object to this. I think one of the things that we're trying to do here is allow the counties an option, and they have, I think in the language and in the conversation, have assured everyone that they will do everything possible to ascertain the desires and wishes of the individual. And I think this is important language, and that this is, according to a funeral director in the Hennepin County area, it is when there is no one available to the family that this becomes actually the easiest to do and the most beneficial, and so to the counties. And so I guess I think it's kind of undoing some of what we're attempting to do for the county in the bill.
Listen, Dean, to your amendment.
Yeah, just finally, I would just say in line 2.30, we say shall provide for the cremation of the person's remains. So we are, in fact, mandating that within this. That's what I have a disagreement with. So I think that would
that would make it more comfortable for me, certainly, and probably others on the committee as well. So,
Mr. Norton, just a question, and then we have some other people who want to talk about the amendment. Is it your intention that that'd be the only way they could provide then for the disposition of an unknown person? That probably reads line 2.30 if that was your intention. But there'd be no option but to cremate them. Is that your right? Is that Mr. Carlson?
Yes,
your
right? Yes, right. And that's why we've added all the language up in 2.18, 2.23 in order to support what we have down at the bottom. So
at the end of the line, you would cremate anybody who you can't figure out.
Mr. Chairman, again, we will be making every attempt to determine the preference, the faith, traditions of the individual, and or the preferences of the spouse or next of kin. But if that cannot be determined, then cremation may be something that we consider, and that is current law.
But Mr. Larson, under the bill, on line 2.30, the county shall provide. So then you have to, is that what you meant? Or did you just want the option?
Mr. Chairman, members, I would not have a problem replacing the word shall with may if that is what being found to be objectionable.
And I will say that, Mr. Chair, that and burial or interment language that we added orally to that was at the request of the religious groups, and I think they would have some issue with us removing that at this point. That was part of their comfort.
Stephanie, would you rather withdraw your amendment and go with shall to may on line 2.30?
I guess I prefer to vote on the amendment first and then see where we go from there.
Discussion to the amendment. Do you all understand it? Anybody want to talk about it? All in favor? Oh, that's in Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I oppose this. I mean, I think that we're in this funding situation where we're not choosing between things that are ideal and things that are bad. We're choosing between lots of bad options. And again, we all talk about wanting to reduce mandates, and this is certainly a mandate. And I think with the oral amendment that was proposed, although we're not voting on that yet, I think this would be quite acceptable. But what we're saying here is that we don't want to give counties the option, and you know, the whole point here is to give flexibility. And as I said before, we're making decisions about where we're going to put very limited and perhaps even declining state funding and taxpayer funding. Obviously counties, a lot of it's going to be property tax money, but it's very limited. And so I think we have to think about it in that way. And it might not, you know, we might all prefer something else, but unfortunately, we make each of these little decisions in a vacuum instead of saying, okay, if we spend the money for this, we can't spend it for that. But I think that if we vote down the oral amendment and then perhaps amend that one shall to a may, I think it would be kind of getting the best of both worlds here. So I'm going to oppose the oral amendment.
There's some people on the list to talk. Do you want to talk to who wants to speak to the amendment? Representative Haas or Scott Walt? Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question for the author of the amendment, Representative Dean. Did you say that you wanted not to have cremation because the body could not be exhumed? Is that what I heard you say?
Representative Dean.
Well, it says we shall provide for cremation services. So in other words, what the amendment says is that if somebody dies and the body is under the responsibility of the county, that it is up to the family to provide, the burden is on the family to provide that this person should be buried and not cremated. That's the first portion of the bill, which I don't have a problem with. This portion of the bill says if we don't know that cremation is the alternate, is the default position, and I guess that Representative Liebling says that based on costs that should be what we're doing. I said that when you don't know, that you would probably choose the more liberal of the two options because you could exhume someone if you later found out who this person was and it was against their faith traditions. I think we're probably not dealing with a lot of people or families with this provision, so I think that that would certainly be more sensitive to the faith traditions of Minnesotans.
Preston Flowers.
Mr. Chair, I was just trying to figure out if you were drawing some kind of conclusion between exhuming and crime and the disposition of the person when you said you don't know who they are. But maybe that was taking it one step farther.
Okay, any other questions on the amendment? Let's vote then. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
It does not prevail. Anybody? Anybody else want to move anything else? May to shall? Shall to may? Justin Gottwald, Justin Tower. You look the same. Tower moves to, sorry. On line 230, moves to change the shall to a may. Discussion about that. I think we discussed it, but any further discussion? All in favor of that one, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That's adopted. Justin Gottwald.
To the amendment as amended?
Yeah, and just remember the oral amendment was incorporated. The internment part and all that was incorporated earlier. So the bill is as amended, maybe for the last time. Go ahead, Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair and Representative Norton and Mr. Carlson, I guess my concern here is I understand what we're trying to do. We're trying to give the county options to cremate rather than bury. But the entire language about having to attempting to contact the deceased spouse or next of kin and determine the burial wishes, I am seeing in that, and I would challenge you to correct me if I'm wrong here, a great deal of additional work for the counties, a great deal of administrative work, and I'm wondering if we've looked at FTEs, a local fiscal note on this. I guess I do see this as, are you actually going to save money, or are you in fact going to create a situation where in most instances you're going to spend a lot more money and time trying to figure these things out than you will actually either burying them or cremating them?
Well, just to encourage you, Mr. Carlson sees local fiscal notes in his sleep when he can't. He just counts them going over a fence. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gottwald, I do want to assure you that I do not see this as an extensive new mandate. If we know through any documentation relating to the recipient that there's next of kin, we will go to the effort of contacting them to see what the deceased or their wishes are for the individual. If we know, and that current practice, this is just in reality codifying current practice, and is not an extensive burden. If we know the base tradition, again, based on the documentation we have for the individual.
One more
shot. Mr. Carlson or Representative Norton, do we have a definition for the term attempt?
Mr. Carlson.
What do we mean by attempting?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gottwald, I believe the attempt will be a phone call followed up by a letter if phone contact is not successful. And once a reasonable period of time has run after those two attempts, we will go forward with the disposition of the remains as governed by the rest of the statute.
Chair, I won't offer an amendment, but I'd certainly feel more comfortable if we would define what it is we're asking the counties to do by attempting rather than just tell them to attempt.
This would be going to the floor, so you could work on that. Justin Thiessen, you want to jump in here?
Just an observation that we did have a fairly extensive conversation about exactly these issues in the policy committee, which is an appropriate place for these conversations. But
maybe we'll hear it again in finance. And then any further discussion of this amendment? Given stage counsel. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails and the amendment's adopted. Do you have anything else you want to talk about?
I have
about
one more amendment.
Okay.
The 809-0378 amendment, and I have one change. This is from NASA.
We have that. Okay. Do members have that?
No. 809-0378.
I think that's going to be passed out pretty soon. We're waiting for that. Representative Gottwall moves to move the minutes. I think they're dandy. And he actually moved the approval of the last minutes, too, so it's kind of a trend. It's your new job. Anybody have any questions about that? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Representative Gottwall votes no. Okay. They're adopted. Do you want to start describing the amendment to us?
I would. On line 2.7 of your amendment, we need to strike everything after the period. Line 2.8 in its entirety.
And oh, no, actually, what? Just don't do the amendment yet, but you want to describe what this amendment does? We don't have it in front of us. It's being passed out so people can't follow it. So just describe what the amendment is to do. The whole thing. Please.
I would let someone else do that if you wouldn't mind.
I want a friend.
1 second.
Take an audience vote.
Members of the committee, I'm Jamie Halpern from Hennepin County, speaking on behalf of Minnesota counties. The intent of these particular sections are to generate new revenues for counties to allow for federal medical assistance reimbursement for the cost of placing children in certain border state facilities. It creates a funding stream that's comparable to the funding stream that's available now for children who are placed in Minnesota facilities. The particular amendments are making technical changes to the bill so that there's no fiscal note to the state. It establishes a state certification process to review the facilities to make sure they qualify for reimbursement. And it also clarifies the roles of counties and health plans when placement decisions are being made.
I was just wondering when this amendment came up and
today. Representative Norton, just in terms of timing, you mean 24 hours? Or
No.
Just in where did it come from?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name, sir. Can you just, what's the origin of the amendment and who thought? Yeah, repeat your name, please, and just for me.
My name is Jamie Halpern. I'm with Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health, and I'm testifying on behalf of Minnesota County's MACSA.
And can you just describe the genesis of this amendment specifically in this?
The question is, is this Senate language we're trying to put on here? Because we do seem to be doing a lot of policy work on this bill, which is going to the floor in this committee, mm-hmm. and we've spent 45 minutes doing that, and we have a whole huge other bill to get there. Maybe that's part of the issue here, but it just strikes me that if it's Senate language, we can do it in conference committee or adopt the Senate language on the floor.
Okay,
so it's more of a comment than a question.
And I appreciate your frustration as author of this bill. If you remember, it had 4 or 5 amendments the first time I brought it to you. And I will say, this is just amending Article 1, which was already, we did have the policy discussion about Article 1. It is amending Article 1 with language that makes certain there's no fiscal note. That's why this is being brought forward today.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Halpern and Representative Norton. Appreciate
it. You're welcome. But I do need to strike that 2 point.
Okay, well, now that the amendment's out, would you now run through your oral amendment, please? Now it's appropriate to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's 2 point, on line 2.7, after the word period, cross out the rest of that sentence, all of line 2.8 and line 2.9 up to the period. It was inadvertently inserted and is not necessary unless some other changes in law happen this session.
That's the only oral amendment you have. So I will move the A090378 amendment, and I will incorporate deleting the language after the period on line 2.7, all of line 2.8, and on 2.9 up to and including the period. Members understand that. I'll incorporate that. Any questions to the amendment, which we're now discussing as well? Representative Flowers.
Mr. Chair, and I somewhat agree with Representative Thiessen. I mean, I brought a bill with 3 amendments to one committee and was totally was told to come back. So we've done an awful lot. Has this been vetted, Representative Norton, mm-hmm. in which committee? And
healthcare policy.
So all of this language has been seen before?
Except for these amendments, yes.
So this amendment?
Yes, this is a technical amendment.
It's a technical amendment. It's huge. And you're telling us it allows children to be placed in out-of-state facilities at no cost or do a cost-sharing type model?
Representative Norton.
Representative Flowers, the first, and we haven't even gotten to the bill, unfortunately. Article 1 was allowing counties the flexibility to save some money by placing children in facilities over state lines should that be closer to their home. That's what the whole Article 1, which was heard in healthcare policy, was about. This technical change originally the bill had counties doing some work to see if the facility was compatible with Minnesota laws. The state has agreed to take that over, and this is making changes to make certain that there's not a fiscal note to that with the state's approval.
Excellent follow-up.
I hope I've explained it.
There's a different chair, too, by the way.
Yes, I know there's a different
chair. Listen, they should give you a plaque at the end of all this. It should be a little counties love you plaque. Any questions to the amendment? I want to go to that ceremony. All in favor of the amendment to A09, whatever the heck it is, 0378, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That's adopted. Is the bill the way you like it now, Representative Norton?
It's the way I think everybody likes it.
Okay, and to the bill, do you want to talk about that?
This is, in short, and very short, this is a bill that was brought forward to help counties by minimizing some of the mandates that they have on them in times of fiscal hardship, which we know we're all facing. This has many different components to it, many of which we just talked about. The residential placement issue, which I think we've cleared up. The cremation and funeral expenses, which I think we've cleared up. The home care, which is also in there. Has a little bit of changes in foster, relative and foster care, a little bit of language and a definition change. There is some health care resident positioning and incontinent residents, which we heard in healthcare policy was a separate bill. That's in here as well. That's now been vetted twice. School district and charter schools has a section in it that modifies how rigorous the county and school district need to be in notifying parents of the ability to apply for health insurance and in fixing that. It also states that it needs to be placed on the web, so they're still contacted, but it alleviates a step in that process, but mandates that it needs to be on a website instead of necessarily one-on-one contact. At the very end, there's a Tom Anzell's bill, I believe, House File 1022, which is Section 8, that hadn't been heard except in healthcare policy, but I don't think there was any controversy surrounding that at all. I believe there's one component in here that I'm missing, that one of the local.
That's fine. We've put it in policy. So actually what we...
I think I skipped over when I...
Is there any money involved at this...
No, I think at this point, now that we've made this amendment, there's no no longer any financial...
Thank you.
Please, to it.
Any questions, Representative Norton, still? Hearing no questions. Representative Norton, I renew the motion. Where is it going to the finance? That the bill be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
You almost got all of us. Very good, Representative Norton. Thank you.
And
good luck with that.
Mr. Chair and members, I appreciate your tolerance with us.
Give a little time. Representative Haas. Okay.
Oh, well, that's a little different animal there.
Okay, I know you're all excited. Another non-controversial bill, Representative Haas.
You weren't with me?
Welcome back to the committee. Do you want to move your bill?
I was with you on that.
Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 60.
Okay, quit having fun. So, Representative Haas moves that this bill be recommended pass and go to finance. Do you have something you want to say about it? Do you have a witness right off the bat, or what would you like, Representative Haas?
Mr. Chair, I'll just do a general overview of the bill, and then I do have an amendment I'll address after the overview. House File 866 is the school employee statewide health insurance bill. It is different from the previous bill that the legislature has considered. I won't go too deep into the policy discussion because we've had that already in health policy.
Maybe you could focus on the money in the bill. That'd be something.
Yeah.
Maybe you could focus on the money.
But mainly health policy, if it takes some of the concerns of the past into consideration, we create a statewide pool using PEEP and the administrative ability for us that we all currently have through PEEP to be able to do the pool. Most of the money situations that this committee would be concerned with, one is with MCHA. MCHA would be held whole with assessments into MCHA to be current, to be at the current levels. Some other costs, concerns are addressed in an amendment that I will be moving here shortly. Probably the last thing that I would have to say is that this bill also has an exemption or an opt-out for self-insured plans to be able to opt-out and maintain in their current self-insured pool. With that said, Mr. Chair, I would like to move the A14 amendment. The A14 amendment deals with a few of the some technical changes with the self-insured opt-out to make sure that if a school does opt out of the pool, that they are out for at least 4 years, that if they do come back into the pool, that they're separately rated for the next 4 years. It also clarifies that an school employee who may go from a self-insured pool into another district that is in the pool does not have to abide by those same provisions. The second section of the amendment addresses some of the cost concerns that the Minnesota Management and Budget indicated in a letter to myself and Senator Dipple, who is the Senate author. And just today, actually 5 minutes before I got here, I was emailed the fiscal note, so we should be able to fill in those blanks once we get to finance to make sure that this bill is fiscally neutral.
All right, Representative Hosh moves the A14 amendment. Are there questions to the amendment? Representative Gottlob.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hosh, just so I understand it, this is basically saying that Education Minnesota, where there is a self-insured plan in a school district, can determine which, if any or all of those, are enrolled in the plan you're proposing, the universal statewide mandated plan, or not. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, my name is Lee Johansson. I'm with Education Minnesota. Representative Gallo, what the opt-out does is allow the exclusive rep, be it Education Minnesota or some other exclusive rep, to make a determination for its employees, which is consistent with the current PEEP statute on a year in which, for instance, this year when we're bargaining, the exclusive rep can make that option. The members are the ones who will have the insurance, the members are the ones who ultimately pay for the insurance, and the members are the ones who would make the decision.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and Representative Hosh, and to the testifier. How many districts is Education Minnesota the exclusive representative for the employees, teachers in particular?
Mr. Johansson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottlob, Education Minnesota represents all of the organized teachers. However, there are many other employees who are represented by other unions other than Education Minnesota, the support staff people, and the bill would provide for those that are unorganized, the district would make the decision for them.
Representative Gottlob.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. So this means that for teachers at least, Education Minnesota throughout the state could say that they are either going to stay in the self-insured pool or enter the mandatory teacher pool. Is that correct?
The local exclusive representative, the local people make that decision. Education in Minnesota itself is not the exclusive rep of any employees. We are the affiliate of exclusive reps. So that decision remains on the local level.
Do you understand that?
Well, yes, Mr. Chair. My concern is, affiliate or not, we've got Education Minnesota will basically be running this pool, and then they will be, at least for the teachers, affiliate or not, they're going to be able to say whether or not these teachers are in or out of the pool. It doesn't really seem to, my assumption would be they would simply direct that those teachers be put into the pool. So I'm not sure what this amendment is accomplishing that improves the bill.
Representative Gottlob, just a having read some emails over the years from this, there are some districts that do not want to go into this thing, and so they're not going to vote to go into it. There's a number, I would predict that, and I think it'll be a free will decision. That's just my comment from watching. But anyway, Representative Hosh.
Mr. Chair, just to address a few things. One is no particular organizational unit will have control over this insurance trust or pool. If you look in Section 7, it talks about the School Employee Insurance Committee, how that's appointed and who the membership is. Also to make sure that the point is driven home, that it is the local representative organization get to choose if they're going to be a participant. If they are self-insured, they get to choose locally if they're going to be a participant in this pool or not.
And just let me ask a question. Mr. Johansson or Representative Hosh, would that be a vote of an entire membership, like they vote on a contract? Would there be is there an insurance committee that's going to vote on this, or an executive council, or would that be a vote of their rank and file? Do you know?
Mr. Chair, each local has a constitution and bylaws that establishes its decision-making process, and they would have to follow their constitution and bylaws.
Oh, whatever it was.
In most instances, that would probably be a vote of the membership, but I don't want to tell you that that would be for certain.
I'm just curious. Thank you. Questions to the bill donate for witnesses. Representative Anvil.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To this point, it's a very important one. The relationship between the local teachers and the local affiliates affiliated with Education Minnesota, the relationship is similar as it would be between local chambers of commerce and the state chamber of commerce. You can just use that as a model.
Okay. I think we'll, any questions to the amendment? Seeing no questions? Oh, that's from Tyson.
Yeah. No, I've forgotten my last question. But well, can you tell me, so this insurance trust fund that you're, can you describe for me exactly what that is?
Representative Hosh, Mr. Graham.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, as I understand it, the current PEAT plan and the State Food Employee Insurance, there's an insurance trust fund that has money in it, and this would be money that would be returned to the trust fund before the end of the biennium, and so it's in effect a cash flow operation that costs the general fund nothing, and by the end of the biennium, the premiums from the insurance would be coming in to take care of that cash flow.
Looks like Mr. Griffin might want to.
Do you want to speak to the amendment or to the bill? The amendment? Okay, to the amendment. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Griffin. So you want to speak to the bill, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. I'm speaking today on behalf of Preferred One, HMO and insurance TPA here in the state of Minnesota. I think I can speak for the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, but we haven't seen this amendment yet and have not had the opportunity since it was just drafted yesterday afternoon to review it closely. But I will point out that I think it's extraordinary that we're dealing with a piece of legislation which is retroactive here back to January 1 of 2009, and I know that this will have an impact directly on my client and some of the school districts that it's working with who are making the decision as we speak to go self-insured because of the work that they've been doing to try and control costs. This is a discussion that we had at length in the policy committee. This seems to me to be a policy decision. I know when I'm arguing process in front of committees that I've often lost the issue already, but I think it's something that's important for the committee to look at. And Representative Hosh has worked hard on this legislation. We appreciate the dialogue that we've had with him, but I want to come back to make one small correction in the proponent's testimony, and that is that we're going to hold MCHA harmless. This bill doesn't hold MCHA harmless. This freezes MCHA assessments at the current level, and as you all know, we've seen a fairly dramatic increase in MCHA assessments. When I started in this business several years back was a $9 million assessment. It's now $90 million a year. If we can freeze health care premiums that way, that would be a wonderful thing, but we aren't able to do that, and that pool is continuing to deteriorate. This will simply add to that. Mr. Chairman, members, my short and sweet is that we would oppose this amendment. The amendment that was added on to give a straight exemption for self-insured is the language that we would continue to support that was added when we were in policy committee, and I'd ask for your support of that and oppose this amendment. If there are questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Can you talk about the MCHA piece? About that?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to.
Like, where in the bill is that? Is that in the bill or in the amendment?
That's in the bill, Mr. Chairman, not in the amendment. So that's why I was just addressing it tangentially.
All right, well, there's a comment. Yeah, I think it deserves a discussion. So if you can just tell us where, just point that
Mr.
out.
Mr. Chairman, the section that relates to MCHA is in Section 10 of the bill on page 4. It talks about the creation of the contributing member. and then further goes on to define the contributing members allocation of losses in sections 11 and 12. And in 12, it talks about in making future year assessments, it must be based on the premiums received by the school insurance employee in that future year from the school employees that on May 1st were receiving that health insurance coverage from the Contributing Members Association. And in my reading of that, that says that we aren't going to continue seeing the inflation that we've seen in MCHA, but we're going to freeze it at that portion, which is not necessarily the total portion of the MCHA assessment that might have been paid by district, whether it was fully insured or self-insured at the time those decisions were made.
And then another question. You said the retroactive part. Can you describe
Mr. Chairman,
that?
The retroactive part I mentioned was the amendment. That's at the line 1.9 on the first page of the amendment, which I guess is just a one-and-a-half page amendment. It says that it relates to school employee districts, which on January 1, 2009, was individually self-insured. That means that it's been January, February, March, April, May, or whenever we finish with this bill being passed. If somebody made a decision during that time, and I know of one district that we're working with that has made that decision and is currently in the process of going through the process of setting this all up, that was the reason for the decision to make a January 1, 2010 effective date in the bill as it comes to.
Just trying to clarify your testimony. Thank you. That helps me. Representative Gottlob, do you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I'll ask for a roll call on this amendment.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chair, I move to divide the amendment after line 1.3.
Okay, say it again. Divide it where?
After line 1.3.
1.3. So after...
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, I'd like to vote on the second half first.
Sure. So the motion is to divide the A14 amendment between 1.3 and 1.4 and vote on the second portion first.
Mr. Chair? Question. Is that division in order, or does that create a conflict in the bill? It seems to me that by voting on the first part without voting on with the second part, you're going to have two separate definitions that kind of help school employers and self-insured work. And you can't really have, it doesn't seem to me you can have one without the other. And so I'm not sure the amendment is there, that division is in order.
We haven't got it. Am I the parliamentarian now? Okay. Do I think it's divisible? That's an abroad advice.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In that case, let's vote on the first half first, and then we'll deal with the fact of whether that provision is still in the bill, and then we won't have the conflict that Representative Thiessen is concerned about. So I'd be happy with voting on the first half of that amendment first.
Mr. Chair, I think that makes more sense.
Okay, well, that's Mr. Johansson.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to comment on the testimony of Mr. Griffin that implied that if this were to pass, the MCHA assessment would be frozen. The fact is that what this does is it freezes a ratio, those that are currently assessed versus those that are currently not assessed. Then as the assessment goes up, the contribution goes up. It's just that what we're doing is holding school employees harmless in terms of which portion of them currently are assessed and which aren't. But as the assessment increases, then the contribution increases in that same proportion. And so it does not, in fact, freeze those contributions as to the rate that was being paid currently.
And actually, ironically, it takes the self-insured piece to dilute the school part. Is that the irony of this whole thing?
Well, one of the ironies is that self-insureds don't pay that assessment
right
now.
I understand.
And so that's correct.
I think it's helpful to clarify what the bill does. And I have one more question to this, and then we'll get to the amendment, I think, that we understand the amendment. In terms of the retroactive thing on the amendment, is it your intention in the amendment to have somebody who was self-insured on January 2nd not to be able to opt out? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, are we doing the division? Are we voting on it, or are we talking about the first piece, or have we gone back to the bill in general?
I guess I get to run the discussion.
I'm asking you.
No, when I hear a question, I'll call on you.
Excuse me?
I'll call on you if you have a question.
Mr. Chair, I'm asking you a question.
Okay, I'm in the middle of my own question, so when it's just mine, I'll call on you for your question.
Well, thank you very much for that respect.
And likewise. Mr. Johansson.
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Well, we had testimony that somebody who was self-insured
later than January 1st mm-hmm. couldn't opt out. Is that what you intended along with designing this bill?
Mr. Chair, yes, the idea is that those that are currently self-insured would have that ability to opt out. We believe that needs to be frozen in place. To our knowledge, there's no one who has become self-insured between January 1st of 2009 and today's date. I know of nobody who has become self-insured, so I suppose we could insert today's date in there just as easily as we could January 1st of 2009. But what we don't want to do is create a mad rush caused by some people who are frightened by the prospect of the plan to create self-insured vehicles that may very well not be sound, because we know self-insurance on an individual district-by-district basis is pretty risky, and the smaller you get, the more risky it becomes. So we don't want to create an environment in which people might rush to something to throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak.
Well, thank you. I think we'll take testimony in the second half for the Emmer advice when that comes up as the vote part, but I still have the question burning in my mind about that piece. So have a chair, Mr. Griffin. We'll get to you in a minute. To the amendment to lines 1.2 and 1.3. Representative Dodd, it's your motion.
Maybe I could enlighten people on why I moved to divide that piece. I think it's important for us to have a discussion, a strong discussion, not just as part of a big amendment, but a very specific discussion related to a discrimination between self-insured individuals and groups. And that's what this amendment does, is that it says, if you're self-insured as an individual, say Rochester or another school that's self-insured as an individual school, you can be exempted out. But all other self-insured entities out there, if you're working together, collaborating, and saving money in that way, you guys are not able to do that. And so I just think that we should have a very specific vote on whether we're going to have a differentiation or a discrimination between how we view self-insured plans through this amendment.
I think that's probably productive. To the amendment, Dr. Emmer, do you want to comment on the first part of the amendment at all? Give me a chance. Okay. You don't have to. Dr. Liebling. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Broad, actually, I originally raised my hand to ask you what you were trying to do, and after your explanation, I still don't really understand it. So, you know, and I have to confess, I don't even know what to ask you. I mean, could you just please, if you would, just try again so that we know what we're voting on in this first case.
Sure. And
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling. Specifically, this will allow us to vote on two lines and two words versus voting on removing that provision out of the bill, which the Health Policy Committee put in the bill, and then adding all this other new language in there. And so it's a very specific, targeted way of making sure that we understand and everybody else understands where we all are on who should be allowed to be exempted out or not. And Mr. Chair, I'd request a roll call.
Roll call's been requested. There'll be a roll call. Mr. Griffin has a comment.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. It's Phil Griffin again with Preferred One, and I just want to comment to Mr. Johansson that there is a large metropolitan school district that's been in the process of trying to go self-insured for many months now. They've spent a large amount of money on consulting fees and getting this ready. They are ready to go, and this would cut them off, and I don't think that's something that you want to do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And members, this is a bill that a lot of us have a lot of deep feelings about, and I think that we get to keep all those deep feelings and policy positions, and this has been around for 7 years or something. And this is one method to address a problem. How many years? 9 years. Sorry, it just seemed like seven. This is one method to address a problem that some of us think is a big problem. And we don't all agree about how we would address it. And this is certainly a work in progress. But as we go through these different amendments, I think we can maintain the decorum that we've all come to appreciate out of each other when we have to deal with hard fights. So, which one first? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hodge, I don't sit on the Health Policy Committee. I'm just sitting on the Finance Committee. And it's my understanding that this portion that we are proposing to eliminate in your amendment was put on in the Health Policy Committee that I don't sit on. Could you talk about whose provision was it to insert this into the bill that we're now in the next committee taking it out, and what was the reason for putting this in?
Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, this was Representative Norton's position, and I can't speak for her, but I believe it was my interpretation that her intentions was to exempt self-insured districts, much like Rochester, Anoka, Hennepin, Minnetonka, who was there to testify. And the amendment that we're dealing with now still would allow those same intentions to be met, but to make sure also that you know, there's standards that if you do opt out, that you can't just hop back right into the pool without any consequences or be an impact to the rating of that pool. So this, I believe, still meets the intentions of the author of the amendment. I have indicated my intentions to do this in committee even, and I would encourage that the committee supports the entirety of this amendment and oppose the division.
Representative Dean, is that the question? Representative Liebling, do you have a question? Yes. Any more discussion? Representative Thiessen.
So just to clarify then, to accomplish what Representative Hodge is trying to do, we want to vote yes on both halves of the amendment, of the divided amendment?
Oh, yeah. That's a, well, what does a green vote mean? Yeah, you have to vote yes to adopt it. So the division is to adopt the first half, and a yes vote is to keep it, a no vote is to take it out. And a no vote...
Okay, I think
that's
understand.
A funny vote we're going to do.
That's why I was wondering whether it was in order, but that's fine.
Oh, yeah.
Do it this way.
So you're suggesting we vote yes on the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I am suggesting that you vote yes on both halves of the amendment. If you vote yes on the first half, the second half, I mean,
I got it.
And if you vote no on the first half, the second half is null and void, and I would... ask the committee to support both halves of the amendment.
Any more discussion to the amendment? And is there a roll call being requested on this half? Representative Brown, do you have a roll call on this part?
Yeah. Yes, Mr. Chair, and I'll be requesting a roll call on the second half as well.
I think the clerk will take the roll unless there's no more questions.
Abler?
Yes.
Anfield?
Yes.
Broad?
No.
Bunn?
No.
Dean?
Nope.
Emma?
No.
Fritz?
Yes.
Scott Wolf?
No.
Hayden?
Yes.
Hosh?
Yes.
Giffmeyer?
No.
Liebling?
Yes.
Murphy?
Yes.
Wachamba?
Yes.
Heffin?
No.
Peterson?
Yes.
Rood?
No.
Scalzi?
Yes.
Lowitz? Powell?
Yes.
Thiessen?
Yes.
Huntley?
There being 12 ayes and 8 nays, the motion, the amendment is adopted. That's part of the first portion. To the second half, discussion, Representative Gottwald, you were first.
Mr. Chair, again, in I don't want to belabor this point too much, but what we set up beginning at line 1.8 in the second half of the amendment, which is now, of course, the whole amendment, is a situation in which the exclusive representative of the employees, and we'll avoid the specific reference to Education Minnesota, even though that's a significant factor, when you look at this, this allows, you've got a district that is self-insured, and now a group representing a group of employees within that self-insured pool can opt out of it, and not opt out of it, but choose to go out of that and into this new statewide pool on a district-by-district basis. So you break up the self-insurance. And if somebody can explain to me how that doesn't happen under this section, I'll defer to them.
Which member of the panel would like to take that one on? Mr. Johansson.
Mr. Chair, both of us don't quite understand the question. If you could ask it again.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hosh, line 1.8 of the amendment begins, each exclusive representative of employees of a school employer, which on January 2009 was individually self-insured. So we got a self-insured district, right?
and we've got the exclusive representative of a group of employees or groups of employees within that already self-insured district, can now choose to break out of the self-insured on a employee group by employee group basis and go into the statewide pool. You can imagine if you're a self-insured entity what that does to your self-insured status, to the integrity of your group, to the insurance that you're offering under self-insured and the finances of that. You're nodding yes, so I assume you're acknowledging that's in fact what happened.
Mr. Graham.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gallo, I think what you say is true, and that is consistent with current law in how locals opt into PEEP. So it is, in fact, a current possibility.
Representative Gallo.
Well, and Mr. Chair, that goes somewhat to my point. How many separate groups like this have opted into PEEP under that provision?
Mr. Johan. Chair, Representative Gottwald, to my knowledge, there is one group of employees that has opted in as an exclusive rep group, as opposed to the entire employer group, and that would be the Alexandria teachers.
And Mr. Hanson, my deep knowledge is a little dusty. I worked on this quite a bit a few years ago in an effort trying to solve the same problem. It's ironic the road leads back to here. After all that time. But isn't PEEP set up that people, the bargaining unit can opt in anyway? That's the current structure of PEEP anyway.
Sure, that's
just in terms of the base operation of PEEP.
That's correct.
President Braun.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I was on a tax committee, so I didn't hear the entire setup of this amendment, so I apologize. But maybe it was inadvertent that one part of the self-insured group was left off, so I'd like to maybe put that group back in. And so after the word individually on line 1.9 of the amendment, I'd like to add the word or as part of a self-insured group. And maybe that was an inadvertent thing done in the amendment, but it seems to me that if the goal is to set up standards, I understand Representative Haas that the goal is to make sure that it's all working in the same way. It seems to me that we ought to have all of the self-insured groups eligible and available to operate under those same standards. And so I don't know if it's inadvertent or intentional, but my goal would be to set that group back in. And Mr. Chairman, I'd like a roll call.
Let's just clarify the amendment, first of all. In 1.9, after individually, you're moving to insert or as part of, then after self-insured, you want to insert the word group. Is that correct?
Correct.
You'll understand the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, just to be clear, what it does is that it just creates a definition that is very similar to what Representative Norton had in the original bill on line 2.31, and it just transfers that definition of either individually or part of a self-insured group into the new amendment, which creates the standards under which they will operate.
Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Broaden to the committee, I would oppose this change. As I said, my interpretation of the amendment when this was added in health policy was to address the concerns of individually insured school districts such as Rochester, Anoka, Hennepin, Minnetonka. This expands that much greater, and we need to make sure that the pool is large enough and at a level that allows economies of scale to be able to prevail. So I would oppose this amendment, and I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if I recall the discussion in health policy, Representative Haas, it wasn't about individually self-insured groups, it was about self-insured groups. And so now, through your amendment, we're going to discriminate between self-insured groups. And so if we're talking about economies of scale, I can't think of why a self-insured group is any less of a large economy of scale than a self-insured individual group. And so it just seems to me that we're essentially putting discrimination between groups into statutes, and I oppose that.
Representative Brown, there's some technical advice maybe from Ms. Cleveland to your amendment. Is that correct?
I think so. So I think it should read on line 1.9, after was, insert self-insured, comma, and then individually or as part of a self-insured group, comma, and delete the self-insured.
Maybe you could read that again, and we'll see if the author likes that better. This is a suggestion that Representative Brown needn't accept it unless you... Okay, could you just read the
or improve?
I'll just read it as it would read.
Please, if you.
So after was, it would say self-insured, comma, individually or as part of a self-insured group, comma, shall determine whether the employees, so forth.
Okay. Yeah, and so Reston and Broad will replace that. So she's moving after was, insert self-insured, comma, and then the rest of the amendment would stand. Is that right, Ms. Cleveland? Or did I get it wrong? How about if you just read it, and that'll be the record of what we do.
Yeah, okay. On line 1.9, after was, insert self-insured, comma, and then after individually, insert or as part of a self-insured group, comma, and then delete the self-insured.
Oh.
Before shall.
Got it. Everybody understand that? Now we'll talk about it. It's been hot.
Mr. Chair, again, I want to say this does not address the needs and the concerns of our smallest districts throughout the state. Pine River Bacchus, for example, had a premium increase of 54%, who was part of a self-insured group, but they're within subpools of themselves. And this will only allow the problems to continue. I would oppose the amendment and encourage the committee to oppose it.
Representative Brown.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that if the other pool is the place where they want to be, all they have to do is to not be self-insured. So they can go into the other pool if they choose to. And I would think that if the monetary reason to be there would be such that it would make sense, they would go ahead and go that direction. And this is really about choice and making sure that we don't discriminate between types of plans.
That's fantastic.
Perfect. So, Representative Posh, if they're part of a self-insured group and in the sub-pool, they couldn't choose to go into the other pool?
That's fantastic.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, what I am saying is for many of our small districts who are part of a larger self-insured group, that they are rated separately, and that's one of the challenges that they have with their rates. And what this amendment would do is get back into, I think, a perilous situation in which those who are most well-off and able to use their math, for example, some of the testimony given with the school district of Minnetonka, who insures 2,300 lives, they don't have the same problems as like a Pine River Bacchus, who may have just simply dozens of employees, or even less than that, who are insured. And we do not need to go into a situation in which haves and have-nots prevail, and this would allow that. We don't need a sick pool that could ultimately end from this. So I would oppose this. Again, I think it takes away the intentions of this bill.
Discussion by members? Everybody fully informed and ready to vote? Okay, the clerk will take the roll.
Abler?
No.
Andrews?
No.
Broad?
Yes.
Bun?
Yes.
Bean?
Yes.
Emma?
Yes.
Fritz?
No.
Gottwald?
Yes.
Hayden?
No.
Hosh?
No.
Giffmeyer?
Yes.
Liebling?
No.
Murphy?
No.
Latremba?
No.
Pepin?
Yes.
Peterson?
No.
Rude?
Yes.
Scalzi?
No.
Frolic? Cal?
No.
Peason?
Yes.
Huntley?
There being 9 ayes and 11 nays, the motion is the amendment's not adopted. To the amendment, any further discussion on the amendment? On the second half of the amendment, the roll call has been requested. Clerk will take the roll.
Abra.
Yes.
Angels.
Yes.
Broad.
No.
Bun.
No.
Bean.
Nope.
Emma.
Fritz? Yes.
Gottwald?
No.
Hayden?
Yes.
Hodge?
Yes.
Giffmeyer?
No.
Liebling?
Yes.
Murphy?
Yes.
Latremba?
Yes.
Pepin?
No.
Peterson?
Yes.
Ruth?
No.
Scalzi?
Yes.
Slowick? Howell?
Yes.
Houston?
No.
Huntley?
We have 11 ayes and 9 nays. The amendment is adopted. Just another, I have a question for Mr. Johansson. I have sat through this 9 years. I can't believe it. I think you're getting closer. I think there's some concerns that remain with the audience and other people. And I hope you've listened to some of those and we can chat in the hallway. This is a big problem. I think we agree there's a problem. Well-intended good people don't agree on the solution. We need to find a solution.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Discussion to the bill as amended. Representative Gottwald.
Well, Mr. Chair, I know we've spent a lot of time talking about the stolen policy as well, but I do want to ask, because I think it goes very much to the point, do we know, either by district or by teacher group or by employee group within districts, who's going to see an increase in their health care costs and who's going to see a decrease? Because it goes to the heart of this bill.
Whichever of you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, I wish I could give you an analysis of every single district plan, be able to do a comparative analysis between like the regular advantage plan at the Keith and what other districts offer. But you know, one plan is not the same as another plan. The advantage plan in Keith is the very same plan that is in CGIP in the state of Minnesota. It's a very good plan. We've done some comparison shopping, I would say, where we've called up districts from my office. For example, the only district that actually got back to us with the price was St. Paul, in which their premiums were over $1,600 a month for a family plan and under CGIP. And again, that's the only comparative that I have, was $1,300. So there was a reduction in cost there. I want to get to Representative Abler's comments that, continue to work to improve this bill. You have my word that I will do that. This bill took some of the concerns that we heard on the House floor from last year. Why not join PEEP? That's what we're doing here. The opt-out for self-insured plan is in here. If there's some concerns with increased costs, I'm willing to consider some strategies which try to buffer some of those concerns with whether it be a phase-in of any premium increases or whatnot. We can talk about that, and I'm very sincere in trying to do that because I do not want to go down the same road that we have in the past. With this amendment, we took some of the concerns of Minnesota management and budget into consideration, and I will continue to do that as we move forward.
Representative Dean. Oh, are you still going?
I think Representative Gottwald had a follow-up.
You want to finish up the Representative Gottwald?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hosh, I appreciate that. And I think the point is, I appreciate Representative Abler's comments about moving this forward and making it better. There is no question that pooling is a good idea in general when the proper consumer protection things are in place, when we can assure fiscal solvency, when we're treating groups of employees fairly, when we're not, in fact, hurting the majority to help the minority. And I think those are some of the concerns. So, I acknowledge what you're trying to do and the benefits of it when it's done properly. But there are, as Representative Abler pointed out, a number of concerns remaining. And I appreciate your openness to working toward improving it. But at this point, it is not at a point where I would feel comfortable throwing my teachers into this.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you. Chair Abler and Representative Hosh. I think that Representative Gottwald's question is the right one. We all want to know who is this going to help and who is this going to harm. I can tell you it's going to harm teachers in Districts 832 and 834 who I represent. And I can tell you that they have not been sending me emails. They've not been calling me. They are not aware that this is moving very quickly through the process. And when they start writing out higher premium checks, they will know that they are losing, and we will hear from them. So I would urge members to get in contact with your teachers in your districts, because they do not know how quickly this is moving through the process. They do not know that this is likely to pass. And the people, the teachers in my district, really would want to know. They would want to be involved in this process. They're emailing me time and time again about teacher certification, which has just been removed from a bill. They don't know that this is moving ahead, but I can tell you darn well sure that they're going to know about it when they start writing those checks. And I think it's imperative upon us representatives to get in contact with our teachers and let them know how quickly this is moving through the process. You talk about an opt-in and an opt-out, not picking winners and losers. That's exactly what this bill does. Teachers in my district have time and time again made concessions and traded benefits for income year after year after year, and they've been responsible, and they're going to be punished by this bill. And I'm voting no, and I think that attentive members should not only vote no, but get in contact with their teachers.
Representative Tremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two schools that have no insurance. And I have other schools that have $1,900 a month for their health care. So we need it in our area.
Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Haas, thank you for bringing this bill. I know you have been working on it. And I hope someday that there is something that I can vote for. I represent a district where I hear from a lot of my teachers, and they do not like this bill, although there are some teachers now who do. And Representative Dean, I'm actually hearing from your teachers, too. So I don't know why they're not sending the emails to you, but they're contacting me. So, you know, it's a tough one. I have a sister who's a teacher who really doesn't, like, she doesn't want this bill. I have a brother who's a teacher who wants it. So, you know, I hope someday that we'll be able to come forward with a bill that's a win-win for everybody. And I'm willing to continue to work with you and talk to you, and thank you for acknowledging that it still needs work and that you're willing to do it.
You want to come and testify? We have another testifier or two. We'll get the pair. I got it. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. Our association represents 341 school districts, or all of the school districts in the state. We are asking for your opposition to this House file. Basically, when we get to health benefits for employees, they are collectively bargained at the table. And things like cash and lieu happen, where employees decide to take a cash settlement instead of health insurance at the table. Other employees in other school districts have invested heavily on their health insurance program and taken less salary. So what we have is a schematic across the state of variables. This bill would put us into the three cheap plans they have listed. And no one has yet been able to explain to me in a collectively bargained unit how you go from wherever you are to these three plans that may be less than what you're presently receiving to then on to whatever the committee decides. So there's two switches that are going to happen. If you follow your local school districts and how they collectively bargain, I think you will understand the enormity that this bill asks us to come up with. And usually you need some cash to change those outcomes if, in fact, you're asking someone to take less health benefits. And there is no additional money this year, members, as you know, and we're looking at very deep cuts across the state in education. And I am pleading with you that this is not the way you want the first dollars that districts see to be spent. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Conklin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. We represent 35 districts in the 7-county metropolitan area. About 40% of the students in the state are enrolled in those districts. Which we appreciate Representative Hosh's efforts here. We know that he is trying to do good things, trying to help and address a very serious issue. Unfortunately, it's a solution that does not work for our member districts, either the employers or the employees. And I will tell you that the ones that I hear from most are not the ones that I actually work directly for, the management side. I hear from the teachers. It's the ones that Representative Rood referred to. I'm on speed dial and speed email from teachers across the metro area asking me, what's going on with this bill? You know, is this really going to happen? Will they really do this to us? To get to the question that came up earlier, who's going to be impacted? Representative Gutwell brought that up. I can tell you who's going to be most adversely impacted. It's those teachers and management that have done the hardest work to control their costs, that have joined, formed joint management labor committees, have tackled this issue head on, have put disease management and wellness programs into place, and brought their costs down, and have had steady premiums for 4, 5, 6 years running. They will be the most adversely impacted. One other comment, just the last bill you talked a lot about relieving mandates. Well, members, this is the mother of all mandates here that would be imposed upon school districts across the state of Minnesota. So we would respectfully ask you to oppose the bill. Thank you.
Representative Brown. Oh, actually, to the any questions for the witnesses? Thank you very much. Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I just, as we try to walk through this difficulty related to health insurance, I recall a chart that was put out a number of years ago when this bill came forward, maybe 4 years ago, I can't remember, but I remember seeing the chart that showed half of my districts, I have 9 districts that touch my legislative district, half of them were winners and half are losers. And so you vote for or against this bill and you say, okay, well, I chose these teachers over these teachers, rather than just giving them all an opportunity to join in, to collaborate, to create those economies of scale, to create those larger pools by their choice, if it fits their district, if it fits the needs of their teachers. You know, Representative Haas, when you talked about the school district, I can't remember if he's one of the school districts that you mentioned during the amendment debate. What this bill does, you were concerned about the situation and what taking them out, they were a group of part of a self-insured group, and if we took them out or allowed them to be exempted, they wouldn't have what they need. Well, that implies that the people sitting at this table know better than the school employees, the superintendent, and the school board members what their teachers, what their community, and what their health insurance situation is, and I reject the fact that I know better than them. So as we pick winners and losers, that's what this does. We could take an approach that allows expansion of pooling in a way that does not hurt the districts that are going to be hurt under this bill, and in a way that helps districts that need the help that I believe that you're trying to bring them. And so this is not the way to go. There's other options out there. I hope the bill continues to move in a different direction, because I'd like you to tell some of the folks in my district why their insurance premiums went up so the other ones could go down. Give them a choice. Give them an option. Give them local control. And that's the opposition of the bill. You know, the other thing, Mr. Chairman, is that I'm wondering in finance if this might be an opportunity for a local impact note to be requested. It seems to me that this would have tremendous local impact in many districts throughout the state. And as districts are struggling to provide what they need to provide in terms of income and in terms of benefits and in terms of salaries, it just seems to me that for us to pass this mandate without a thought or a care about it, what it means to the local taxpayers throughout the state, is a shame. And so I will be asking Representative Diskins to request a local impact note in addition to the fiscal note that I believe is going to be coming forward on this bill. The local impact notes are important for us to be able to make a decision based on quality, comprehensive information as to what it actually does when it hits the ground, and that's what we're talking about.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think a lot of it's been said, and of course I have 7 districts that touch me, and some are winners, some are losers. Some people support this, some don't. I feel a lot of the teachers in my area personally have been they're not informed as to what this could potentially mean for them. So I'm not going to go into a long tirade or anything, but I do want you to think about whether or not you do think it's a good policy to help some but hurt others, and picking winners and losers. I know there are areas in the state that need this, but I really think that we need to look for other answers, because this really is going to hurt a lot of the people that especially the metro area folks represent. And Mr. Chair, I just want to ask for a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. There'll be a roll call. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I've been involved with this for 9 years also, and I've heard the same arguments year after year, and I've heard the issues about winners and losers. Personally, I think everybody's going to be winners in the end. You know, we all belong to a large pool as state representatives. The state employees all belong to a large pool that the state can have. The college faculty belongs to a large pool. And it really astounds me that we can't put together a large pool for all the teachers around the state that will meet their needs. And I come from a metro district, a large metro district, and when I go around to the schools, which I have been doing the last month, the biggest concern for them are the large dues or payments that they have to make on their health insurance every month. And it does range from $1,200 a month out of their paycheck and up. Now, that's the teachers. Obviously, the administration doesn't feel the same way, but the teachers do. And they're very concerned, and they feel, many of them, that they cannot sustain, particularly if they're a single wage earner, that they cannot sustain these kinds of prices or the amount of cost for their health insurance. And so I think we need to start doing something substantial to assure that all of our teachers, all of our school personnel around the state have access to a statewide plan. And this one, I think, has been modified from and has taken on the challenge of trying to meet all of the concerns that have been expressed over the past 4 years, 5 years, and yet there may be some things that still need to be done, but I certainly hope that we can put together some kind of a statewide health insurance plan that meets the needs of teachers all around the state, including the metro area.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had not planned to wait in, but when we got back to the issue of pooling and mandatory, I just want to make one comment. One thing that we've heard throughout this time in the years, and one thing that research has addressed, is how large the pools need to be. And this is creating a pool, if I remember correctly from the debate in previous years, of over 200,000. And pooling does have its advantages. And when we hear these districts that have, you know, a dozen or very small number of employees, obviously there's a serious problem here in these rural areas that we need to address. But from what I can tell from all the the evidence that was presented in the last couple of years is that pooling, you know, maxes out at the kinds of scale at around 40 to 60,000. And clearly, I think the numbers of districts that would voluntarily opt into this would be in that range or higher in this state. And so we would have pools of exactly the kinds of numbers that would be effective to bring these benefits along. And therefore, the thing that's holding this up, in my view, and while we're not needing a final resolution, is that the main issue is this mandatory versus voluntary, and we have to deal with the moral hazard issues of having, you know, just unhealthier groups into the pool. But I think in the kinds of numbers we're talking about, it was clear to me that that can be achieved here. So I'm hopeful that, so as to avoid another veto of this bill in the end, we can resolve the long-term issue that's before a lot of these districts, that we can address this mandatory issue and get this thing signed. I would love to see that happen.
Well, I think we're almost done. I just want to offer a couple more comments. Odd to be the chair of the committee on this particular day on this bill, at odds with my group of colleagues on my side of the aisle. Tried to be fair, hope I was. Why would Abler be supporting a bill like this? Why on earth is all he knows about health care? I was an opponent of this thing, must have been for 6 years, and nothing got done. I just want to remind you about my district. They're actually the ones at risk. Revenue prices go up. They're a very good district. Their trend is about 6%. They pay about $24 million into a pot, which they self-insure out of, and they draw the money in and out of that. But just to point out that the people at risk here are the people who want this to have a chance to go forward. The teachers are the ones that are going to lose if this thing fails. The districts generally have a finite pot of money. Anoka District bargains out of whatever number it is this year, but there's a pot of money that they have to put into the health plan that they can contribute, and nothing more. The teachers want a better package that adds into their particular cost. And so if it blows up, the district, my district, is out $24 million or whatever, and not anything more. The teachers are out. And luckily, we have a large group of people that seems to work it, but still it's not a true pool. It's still too small. And why mandatory, and why would I risk that and Minnetonka and Stillwater and other ones? If you just have a little one that are running $1,900, you have a group of high-risk, small districts, and it doesn't work. And otherwise, they don't do anything.
And this is kind of a bargaining process. I see the bill getting better. I think it's way better than it was 9 years ago, don't you think? And we have to find something together that the governor can sign that can actually work. And I don't see him signing this yet. I see it moving in a direction that gets closer. And I think some of the objections at the table have to be heard. So I'll be voting for this yes again to move the process forward. To give Representative Hosh the leverage he needs to keep the dialogue going and the people that he's working with. And I hope when the dust settles, we do something to help out these good employees of ours that do such a good service in the state. So, anybody else want to be heard on this? Anybody in the audience wants to testify that hasn't had a chance to express their point of view? Seeing not, the clerk will take the roll.
Abler?
Yes.
Angels?
Yes.
Broad?
No.
Fun?
No.
Dean?
No.
Homer?
No.
Fritz?
Yes.
Gottwald?
No.
Hayden?
Yes.
Hosh?
Yes.
Giffmeyer?
No.
Liebling?
Yes.
Murphy?
Yes.
Petremba?
Yes.
Pepin? He's gone?
Yes.
Peterson?
Yes.
Reed?
No.
Wallach?
Yes.
Galvey? Excuse me. Galvey is a yes. Wallach?
Yes.
Hal?
Yes.
Peterson?
Yes.
And,
Pepin? No.
Pepin?
No.
No. And Huntley?
Yeah.
Okay.
There being 12 ayes and 8 nays, the bill is passed and referred to the Committee on Finance. And there's a meeting tomorrow at 2:30 for another Hosh bill. Is this you want to just mark your calendars for that one, members?
Room 5.
Mr. Bruner, I think the Hosh bill tomorrow
room will be 5.
A great policy discussion and not nearly as contentious.
Thank you. We're adjourned. Thank you.